From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Published reports claim the Trump administration claims the right to deport thousands of Vietnamese Americans who arrived in the U.S. prior to 1995. Previous administrations have interpreted an agreement with Vietnam as blocking those deportations. Well, how are Southern California's Vietnamese residents responding? We'll find out after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Hope your Friday's going well and you have a nice weekend planned. We're going to do everything we can to help you enjoy it all the more this busy time of year when top films are getting released. We have some big titles this week. Our critics reviewing the animated Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse already. One of the best-reviewed films of the year. It won the L.A. Film Critics Association Best Animated Feature Honor. We'll hear about Mary Poppins Returns, starring Emily Blunt and Lin-Manuel Miranda. And If Beale Street Could Talk, from Moonlight's Barry Jenkins, the writer-director of the Oscar-winning Best Film. Jenkins back with If Beale Street Could Talk. Also, Clint Eastwood directs and stars in The Mule. Many more movies. Very big week. But first, we begin with news that hits Southern California hard. We get the word, according to The Atlantic, which broke the story, that the Trump administration is looking at reinterpreting an agreement with the Vietnamese government, which deals with deportation procedures for those who arrived in the country prior to 1995. With us, foreign policy reporter for The Atlantic, who broke the story, Krishnadev Kalamur. Krishnadev, thank you for being with us.
Pleasure.
So first of all, historically, how has this agreement been interpreted for dealing with Vietnamese refugees who don't have legal status or who've committed crimes? How's that been considered under this agreement?
Well, firstly, it was an agreement signed in 2008, and the two sides, the U.S. and Vietnam, agreed that while people who came here after 1995, July 12, 1995, and had criminal records but were not U.S. citizens, they could be deported. But those Vietnamese nationals who came to the U.S. before July 12, 1995, that's the date when the U.S. and Vietnam normalized relations, but they could not be deported under this agreement. And that was signed in 2008 under the Bush administration, and that was the interpretation that the Obama administration also followed.
You quote in your story a spokeswoman for the Department of Homeland Security, Katie Waldman, who says, "We have 5,000 convicted criminal aliens from Vietnam with final orders of removal. These are non-citizens who, during previous administrations, were arrested, convicted, and ultimately ordered removed by a federal immigration judge. It's a priority of this administration to remove criminal aliens to their home country. Is it your understanding that there are as many as 5,000 Vietnamese Americans, the number she cites here, who could be deported by the administration?"
That sounds right. The numbers are high, relatively high, I should say, because the community itself obviously is very large. But at the same time, the Democratic House lawmakers whom I've spoken to have basically pointed out that many of these people came to the U.S. right after the Vietnam War. They were placed in depressed communities. Many of them suffered PTSD, and they committed actions, which were criminal actions, and they got convicted and served their time. And because they were not U.S. citizens, they were ordered removed. The 2008 agreement, however, protected them from deportation. But it looks now that if this goes ahead, they will be removed, yes.
Has there been a response from the Vietnamese government to this, or is this all so fresh from your reporting and Charles Dunst, your co-author, that they haven't had a chance to respond yet?
Well, it's a two-part thing, because Trump administration actually began this because they have been actually deporting criminal aliens from different countries since last year, and they began this actually in the spring of 2017. And they sent back a few dozen Vietnamese to Vietnam. The Vietnamese government initially took them back, but then they increased their resistance to it. There was also a class action lawsuit which prevented the which basically prompted the administration, Trump administration, to suspend the plan. So far, we've tried to reach out to the Vietnamese government. They haven't said anything about the latest possible rule change. But I suspect we will hear something back.
So these would be people who would have been in the United States for at least 23 years, if not longer. And if they had ties to U.S.-backed side in the Vietnam War, would they potentially face retaliation from the current Vietnamese government?
I mean, this is one of the big questions because, as you point out, you know, it's a prolonged conflict. The U.S. picked the South Vietnamese, and many of the people who ended up in the U.S. were from South Vietnam. I mean, Vietnam's a very different country now, obviously, and the two countries have mended fences. But at the same time, it's very hard to tell what sort of repercussions or recriminations they face if they go back to a country that many of them probably don't really know anymore.
We're talking with Krishnadev Kalamur, who is a reporter, foreign policy reporter for The Atlantic, co-author of the piece reporting on the Trump administration's change in interpretation of policy on deportation of longer-term residents from Vietnam. Also with us, Ann Do, Los Angeles Times reporter who covers Asian American issues and Orange County news generally. Ann, good to have you with us again.
Thank you, Larry.
Someone who's very connected with the communities of Vietnamese Americans in Orange County particularly, what have people been saying to you about this?
This news has sort of hit people as sort of a shock because they thought that these deportation issues only applied to other communities, not their own. And what I'm finding by going around to the storefronts and on the streets is that it's staged sort of a dividing line between generations. The older generation does not want to talk about this because they're mainly focused on political situations in the homeland, while the younger generation says there are urgent political crisis right in our own backyard that we need to advocate for.
Now, I know you've also been pursuing this story in D.C. Have you been able to get anyone to confirm The Atlantic's reporting on this?
Molly O'Toole, our immigration reporter in D.C., is working on making calls about that. So great job on The Atlantic story.
Thank you.
All right. But still working to confirm. Krishnadev, let me go back to you. How did you find out about this?
Well, my colleague Charles Dunst, he's based in Southeast Asia, and he heard about it, and he'd done some reporting about it back last year when the first group of Vietnamese were deported, and it caused the ambassador at the time was removed from his position, and I think Charles got to know him and spoke to him about the things that had happened. And I think he also heard back from advocacy groups who work with the Vietnamese community in the U.S. about this meeting that was supposed to happen between DHS and Vietnamese officials, and he couldn't really confirm it. So when he reached out to me and my editor, I put in a few calls and I was able to confirm that a meeting did take place and we were able to put that story together.
Also joining us, Phi Nguyen, who is litigation director for the legal advocacy group Asian Americans Advancing Justice Atlanta. Phi, thank you for being with us. Share with us your thoughts on how many people you think are potentially going to be deported because they're either in the country illegally or have a criminal background.
Sure. Thank you for having me. So I heard the number 5,000, but we think the number is actually higher than that. There aren't numbers that are exact because DHS does not track, they don't necessarily track the date of entry of Vietnamese immigrants. But we think it's somewhere closer to between 8,000 and 9,000.
What kind of legal advice are you giving to pre-95 arrivals who would be at risk of deportation?
Well, it's been very difficult. We're actually the lawyers who are representing a class of pre-1995 Vietnamese in a class action against ICE. And we did have some temporary relief where the U.S. said in our court proceedings that they were backing off of the pressure that they were putting on Vietnam to change this agreement. And they said that as recently as October. And so our community sort of breathed a collective sigh of relief. And so when we heard news that the U.S. was continuing to put pressure on Vietnam, then things are just really uncertain. And so there's not a lot of legal advice that we can give right now. We just have to sort of wait and see how things shake out.
I want to read to you a clause that's in the agreement between the U.S. government and the Vietnamese government. I just read the agreement because I was curious how it's been interpreted in these two different ways. But Article 2, Clause 2 reads, Vietnamese citizens are not subject to return to Vietnam under this agreement if they arrived in the United States before July 12, 1995, the date on which diplomatic relations were reestablished between the U.S. And the government, U.S. government and the Vietnamese government. And then the next sentence is this. The U.S. government and the Vietnamese government maintain their respective legal positions relative to Vietnamese citizens who departed Vietnam for the United States prior to that date. You're a lawyer and I'm not, but it seems to me that says this agreement has no bearing on those who arrived prior to 1995, and whatever the status quo had been for how to deal with those people continues independent of this agreement. But how do you read that clause?
Well, the status quo that was in place before the agreement was signed is that virtually no Vietnamese people could be deported, or very, very few could. And so when the agreement was actually originally signed, it actually evoked a lot of fear and anxiety, and it also it created a situation where elected officials also spoke out against it because it was for the first time creating a process that any Vietnamese people could be deported back to Vietnam. And it seemed that the sort of compromise that was struck there was that people who came before 1995 would not be deported, and the vast majority of people who came before 1995 were refugees from the war.
We're talking with Phi Nguyen of Asian Americans Advancing Justice in Atlanta. Also with us from the Center for Immigration Studies, Executive Director Mark Krikorian. Mark, good to have you with us again. Your thoughts on this reporting that the Trump administration is looking at the potential deportation of pre-95 Vietnamese refugees?
Well, I mean, it's long overdue. We never should have reestablished diplomatic relations with Vietnam without having as a precondition an agreement that they take back their people. About 1 million Vietnamese have moved to the United States since the communist takeover of the South. Half of them came before 1995, and they have, in effect, been exempt from immigration laws since then. And they're, this isn't just people washing dishes or doing landscaping. There's a guy, Tim Minh Le, for instance, who came here illegally in 1990, so it's before that agreement. He was jailed for shooting a man. When he was released, he could not be deported. He had to be let back onto the streets, and he went and slit the throats of two of his fellow gang members. Another guy, Binh Thai Luc, came here in 1989. He was convicted of armed robbery, served his sentence, was let out on parole, but could not be deported. That was unfortunate for a Chinese immigrant family in San Francisco, five members of whom he murdered.
Okay.
This is an essential agreement, and I think the reason they're doing this now is that it's up for renewal next month, and they're basically sending Vietnam a message, you need to change this agreement and take back your own criminals, or we're going to issue visa sanctions as the law requires and not issue visas to people in Vietnam.
What about, Mark, though, the clause that I just read in which it says in this agreement that both governments maintain their respective legal positions relative to Vietnamese citizens who departed Vietnam for the U.S. prior to that date. And if the legal position was that there would not be deportation of pre-95 arrivals, then how does starting to deport those individuals now, how does that comply with the agreement given that clause?
There's 2 points. First is I'm not even sure what that clause means. You know, that's actually vague, and it's referring to other things that we're not, that I don't know about. And that's number one. Number two, the only way we can deport one of these murderers, for instance, or other violent convicted criminals to Vietnam is if Vietnam agrees to it. We can't just fly over the country and drop them off. So if Vietnam accepts them back, then we have, then we've got a new deal, basically, a new arrangement, which is what the administration seems to be trying to negotiate. What the Atlantic announced was simply a decision that these people are in fact deportable, as they always have been, at least legally, and the administration is going to attempt to change the rules. If Vietnam just says no deal, then we can't deport them. But like I said, what is almost certain to happen, and this is presumably already happening in discussions, behind closed doors now, is that as we have done with other countries, so-called recalcitrant countries that refuse to take back their own citizens, is that we shut off visa issuance, that, for instance, government employees will no longer be issued any sort of visas or that sort of thing.
So retaliate if they don't agree to it. Let me bring Fee Nguyen of Asian Americans Advancing Justice. Your response to Mark Krikorian saying that when you've got violent criminals, people like that, and they're Vietnamese citizens, they should be deported.
Well, a couple of things, and I think this goes back to the circumstances under which a lot of Vietnamese immigrants actually came to the country. They came after they were traumatized by war and put into neighborhoods that were resource poor, and they didn't have some of the resources that they needed. And as a result of that, they were at risk of falling into the criminal justice system. And so with some of the individuals we're talking about people who may have committed crimes in their teens and serve time, and then since then have been law-abiding Americans who have started a family, who have U.S. citizen spouses or children. And the reality is they served their time in jail or in prison, and the criminal justice system has deemed that they are safe to return to live in society. And so that would be one of my responses to that. So the idea that this policy is motivated by a desire to get rid of people are dangerous is just not really true.
All right. Fee Nguyen with us, Asian Americans Advancing Justice. Back to the Atlantic's Krishnadev Kalamur. The potential negotiations with Vietnam, what's your sense of that country's openness to in renegotiating this agreement, including pre-95 U.S. arrivals?
They have in the past been fairly resistant to taking back their citizens. The 2008 agreement, for instance, took a decade to negotiate, so it's by no means a slam dunk. I think, the administration certainly has, as Mr. Krikorian pointed out, certainly has leverage in that it can deny Vietnamese visas if they don't, agree to this rule change. But it's quite hard to tell. They aren't, the government in Vietnam, their decision making isn't exactly transparent, so it's quite hard to tell what they might actually do. But, the U.S. also has levers that it can pull to make to come up with a satisfactory solution that it deems satisfactory.
So what Mark was saying about potentially retaliating by denying visas for Vietnamese government people,
that's right.
That would be a way of pressuring the country to agree to take these individuals back.
That's correct. That's what the U.S. typically does when countries decline to take back their citizens who've been convicted of crimes in the U.S.
All right. Ann Do, Los Angeles Times reporter, who's closely connected in her reporting with Orange County and its residents. Ann, you mentioned earlier that there is a generational divide over this issue. What's the view of younger Vietnamese Southern Californians? Do they think it would be better not to deport those who arrived before 95 who have been convicted of crimes?
I think the views echo what Phi Nguyen was saying earlier. They believe that these people have served their time and they deserve a second chance. They think that because the community has been quiet on this issue involving undocumented people or people with criminal records, that they've been ignored. The community focuses on human rights violations, and many of the young people believe that by denying those under threat of removal a place, a comfort space in Southern California, would be denying their human rights.
All right. And thank you so much. Is this in Vietnamese language media, is this the top story right now?
It is among the top stories for those media progressive enough to cover it. Because, again, it's one of those untouchable, quiet topics. Let's not lose face over the fact that we have a number of people of undocumented status in our community.
Ann, as always, thank you so much. Good to have you with us. It's Ann Do, Los Angeles Times reporter. My thanks as well to our other guests for joining us. And, of course, you'll hear continuing coverage on the policy should it be fully implemented right here on 89.3 KPCC, given the significant size and influence of our Vietnamese-American residents of Southern California. Coming up, a major publication in conservative media closing down. We'll talk about the reasons behind that and how conservative media are shifting since the election of President Trump, back in 1 minute. I was sad to hear last night of the death of Nancy Wilson, the wonderful singer. She died at her home in Pioneertown up in the high desert, age of 81. She'd retired from performing a few years ago. I was so disappointed. I was talking with her agent. She said, yeah, Nancy's retired. I said, why? I just heard her at the bowl. She sounded so good. But she'd been retired for the past few years. But what an extraordinary voice. So many great recordings. So many terrific live performances. Nancy Wilson, she didn't like being called a jazz singer. But she sang jazz beautifully. Nancy Wilson, dead at the age of 81. They're putting flowers out on her star on the Walk of Fame in Hollywood today. Good to have you with us on Air Talk as we discuss the demise of the Weekly Standard, a 23-year-old conservative media outlet founded by Bill Kristol. And it had been very outspoken in its criticism of President Trump, seeing him not as a true conservative or adhering to historic Republican conservative principles. With us, The Hill's media reporter and columnist Joe Concha. Joe, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So give us a little background. What led to the demise of the Weekly Standard, which for so long was a highly influential conservative publication?
Well, I think because they primarily took a side, and that's fine because, you know, these publications are not here to report the news objectively. They're here to give perspective and opinion. And overwhelmingly, it was anti-Trump. It was known as the home of Never Trumpers. And that's fine, but it seemed like there isn't really much of a base of readership for that. You're either with the president. If you look at Gallup polling, for instance, his party loyalty numbers are somewhere around 90%. Okay, so even though his regular RVP average amongst all people is 40%, the point is that there isn't much of a Republican base anymore, is what this told me. And if you're anti-Trump, you're only going to have Republican never Trumpers for you at that point, which amounts to, as I said, about 10% of all your prospective readers out there. And Democrats aren't going to go to read the Weekly Standard, liberals, progressives, whatever you'd like to call them. So they kind of box themselves into a very niche audience And when you do that in this world where publications are letting off people left and right, with the exceptions of the Washington Post and New York Times, the major ones, this is your result. So, Bill Kristol just sent out a tweet about an hour ago saying that it's the end of the Weekly Standard. And I think the real shocking part is how quickly this all came about. It went from it's there to it's gone, basically within reporting of 3 weeks.
Yeah, Joe. And I wonder what this means for other conservative publications. I think of National Review or newer ones like Daily Caller or The Federalist. Are, to your knowledge, others also in trouble?
As far as I can tell, and from what I've read, the places like the Daily Caller and the Federalist are doing pretty well. And I think it's because, again, they are very pro-Trump for the most part in terms of their coverage. And there's a lot more of those kinds of people out there on the right than there are anti-Trump on the right, I'm only talking. So, yeah, they're doing well. And for the time being, it seems like they're doing fine. As I said, The Washington Post and New York Times are experiencing record subscription numbers. So they're doing fine in terms of more of the negative coverage towards the president. And then the cable news networks, CNN is down for 2018, about 6%. But the other cable networks saw record numbers they haven't seen in Fox's and MSNBC's 22-year history combined. They both had their best years ever. In fact, Fox was the most watched station on all of cable, like when you throw in ESPN and TNT and all those other stations. So, yeah, it just seems like you have to take a side now at this point, which is very unfortunate. You're either against the president or for the president. And if you're somewhere in between, you're going to have some problems.
Well, it's fascinating that CNN, which has set itself up now as being an antagonist to the president, that it's not doing well following that model, while the New York Times and Washington Post are doing superbly with that.
That is amazing, right? And I think the reason why is you just have to think of a pie, all right? Get a pie in your head, all right? The holidays are coming up, a nice circle, okay? And you split that right down the middle. 50% of it goes to Fox in terms of viewership, right? So there's half your audience because Fox doesn't have a real challenger on the right from a broadcast perspective. Then when you look at the left and the other part of that pie, MSNBC, which has been left since it began, takes about 30% of that part of the pie. And then all that's left is CNN, which takes 20%. In other words, they're competing with MSNBC for the same audience, leaving the other half to Fox. And the thing is, MSNBC is very transparent about who they are. They're the lean forward network. They're progressive. They're leading faces, Rachel Maddow. CNN still, even though they're anti-Trump, kind of still portrays themselves as like an objective, unbiased network, and every study and analysis I've seen says that's clearly not the case. So I think that's the problem. They have an identity crisis at this point. They're anti-Trump, but they say they're objective, and they're competing with MSNBC's audience, and that's what's leading them to being a very distant third place right now in the cable news race.
The Hill's media reporter and columnist Joe Concha joining us on Air Talk. One of the ironies here is that I was reading about the demise of the Weekly Standard and said actually web traffic had been up since the election of President Trump, but it's how you get those visitors to pay for the thing. That's the conundrum.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're seeing more subscription models out there now where you have to pay for content. Because you can't pay all these writers and all these people that are working in your advertising department, your whole staff, and the stuff you're giving away is free, right? You go onto the internet and there it is. So what are you paying for? And that's the thing. If you have a print publication, you're probably not going to do well. I mean, I try to still go out and buy the New York Times every Sunday because I kind of like the whole feel of having it in my hands. But
yeah.
I know I'm an anomaly.
Yeah, I get two newspapers daily delivered to the house. That's how much a dinosaur I am.
Do you?
Yes.
Walk around your neighborhood or are you in like more of an urban environment? See a lot of newspapers outside of.
Yeah, I see a few, but it used to be, you know, when I moved into the area, my neighborhood 20 years ago, almost everybody got the newspaper. Now it's just, you know, a scattered few. And like everybody else, I consume news much more heavily online, but I still want the tactile experience of going through the papers each day.
Yeah, sure. And I do as well. But again, I think we're dinosaurs.
Yeah, we are. It's expensive to have that happen. That's very true. Joe, as always, a pleasure. Thanks so much for talking with us about the demise of Bill Kristol's magazine, The Weekly Standard. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure. Have a good weekend.
You too. Joe Concha, media reporter and columnist for The Hill. Coming up next, we talk about the ongoing debate over spanking. Still, a majority of Americans approve of it, according to the polls that I've seen. Nonetheless, almost uniformly, Health advocates say it's harmful, that it does more harm than good in disciplining a child using that kind of physical approach. We'll talk about the case of a Central Valley-based legislator who was arrested a few days ago on misdemeanor child abuse as a result of a spanking he gave his 7-year-old daughter, the controversy that's engendered. It's Air Talk, back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Herdes. Pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I almost can't wait for film week. We got some big movies I want to hear all about from our critics. They include Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, the animated film that's had reviews to die for so far. We'll find out what our critics think about it. You know, Charles Solomon, he's a tough man to please. So I want to hear what Charles has to say about Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Mary Poppins returns, starring Emily Blunt and Lin-Manuel Miranda, and If Beale Street Could Talk, written and directed by Moonlight's Barry Jenkins. Those are all coming up on Film Week. A few days ago, Democratic Assemblymember Joaquin Arambula was arrested on a misdemeanor child abuse charge after spanking his 7-year-old daughter before bed, before a school day. The next day, the daughter complained to a teacher that she had been spanked by her father, and apparently there was some physical evidence of the spanking. And as a result, Arambula was arrested on misdemeanor child abuse charges. And according to the assembly member, he's been getting a lot of feedback from his constituents, including those who have come to his defense. Now, the assembly member has said that he is welcoming parenting classes, learning other methods that don't involve physical discipline with his child. He and his wife have 3 kids temporarily taken out of their custody while an investigation was undertaken. Then they were returned to the couple's custody. But my question for you is, when you look at spanking, whether it's a case of whether a mark is left, as is alleged in this case, or even spanking that doesn't leave a physical mark, what are your thoughts about the effectiveness of it? This is something that is deeply ingrained for so many people. The most recent surveys I've seen of Americans shows slight approval for physical punishment, spanking. But again, it's a highly divisive issue. You have celebrity sports figures who've defended the spanking of kids as a necessary or at least potential option for parents in disciplining kids. I'd like to hear from you what you think about it. We're at 866-893-KPECC, the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. With me is attorney Paul Wallen, who is a firm based in Tustin. He defends those who are accused of child abuse. Mr. Wallen, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, great to be here.
What is the demarcation between legally permissible? I'm not talking about, you know, this the opinion of whether it's good parenting or not, but legally permissible spanking of a child versus what isn't, what crosses to misdemeanor or even felony abuse?
Well, it's interesting because the standard of reasonableness have changed dramatically over the last 30 years. 30 years ago, it was reasonable and legal to swat your child with a belt, even if it left a mark, because the general, just at that time, community morals was that that was okay. But as time goes on and the new generation, it's not reasonable, for example, to spank your child with a belt. Ultimately, the court has to look at all the surrounding circumstances. And in general, it's fair to say that if you spank your child with an open hand on the bottom and it leaves a mark that goes away within 24 hours, that is seems to be deemed reasonable, and you're not going to have your kids taken away for that. The problem we face is that there are so many mandatory reporters in the schools that as soon as a teacher sees a mark on a child and they believe it's caused by a parent, they have to, by law, call Child Protective Services or they can go to jail, and that's what starts the investigation, which is exactly what happened here with this assemblyman.
Mm-hmm. And so the fact that it did leave a mark, does that then leave him the potential of being prosecuted for the misdemeanor child abuse charge?
It does. make it possible, but in my opinion, it's much more likely this case is not going to be filed from what I have read, in that it appears that his conduct in disciplining the child with an open hand and not any other object seems reasonable, even if it leaves a mark. But of course, it also depends on the underlying circumstances. A parent is not allowed to strike a child out of anger, no matter what. If a parent is disciplining a child because that child normally knows what the discipline is going to be and gets that discipline, that could make it more reasonable. And that is why I think, from what I read in the article so far, it's probably not going to be filed. They're going to go to counseling, parenting classes, and it will likely not be filed.
We're talking with attorney Paul Wallen. His firm is based in Tustin, Wallen and Klarich. Again, I'd like to hear your thoughts about spanking. Do you think it is an acceptable method of discipline for a child? What do you think are the limits on it? Do you think the law has it right or not? 866-893-KPECC. Also with us from USC, Assistant Professor of Social Work, Elizabeth Kim. Professor, good to have you with us.
Hi, good to be here.
I know that there seems to be, from pediatricians to social workers, a consensus that spanking is always harmful. What is the research that leads to that conclusion?
Right. So there's been a lot of debate, even in research, regarding the effect of spanking. But the recent research that was released, conducted by Drs. Gershoff and Grogan-Kaler, speak to the kind of spanking that does not include hitting with an object, so hitting with an open hand. And even that kind of spanking, research has shown that that's associated with more aggression, more antisocial behaviors, externalizing, internalizing problems, mental health problems, negative relationship with parents, I mean, a whole slew of negative outcomes, and also related to negative adult outcomes in terms of mental health and antisocial behavior. It's also related to lower moral internalization, cognitive ability, and lower self-esteem. And I think the biggest risk here is that spanking alone has these risk factors, but then it's also that spanking could potentially lead to physical abuse. That's much more than just one swat on the butt.
I'm wondering, in these studies, I mean, one of the challenges when we've talked about this over the years is the studies disentangling the fact that spanking may be more prevalent in families where there is generally more of a history of violence, more stress within the household. So how you disentangle the spanking itself from all the other social factors that are coming into play, how do you do that in a study?
So the way that we do it in research is through you could control for the level of those risk factors or the stress levels. And that's been done before, and that's all we've also research has also looked at differences across race and ethnic groups. But it's pretty clear that there's a consensus around depending even if you control for race or the stress level, the negative effect of spanking is there. It's consistent across race and ethnic groups. It's consistent across, and especially, actually, one of the studies have shown that in those contexts with families with higher stress level, the effect of spanking is actually more negative than groups that don't have that kind of stress.
All right. I'd love to hear from listeners. What do you think? And do you think that research should be blanketly applied by parents? Or do you think that it's a case-by-case basis? What's your view of spanking? Is it ever appropriate in disciplining a child? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk with Kelsey in San Pedro. You're on Air Talk.
Hi, my name's Kelsey. I am 28 years old. My mom was a fan of the wooden spoon and the belt. I was a pretty quick learner. If I were to ever step out of line or say something that was uncouth or uncourteous or something that warranted a spanking, I learned pretty quickly. I only had to make the same mistake once, or maybe only had to make a mistake once in order to learn that I would get the wooden spoon or get the belt. I mean, she by no means, my mom by no means, abused me with it.
Kelsey, let me ask you then, if you have kids, I don't know if you do now or if you're intending to in the future, but would you be leery of using physical discipline because of what the studies show about it? Or would you take the positive experience you're describing with your mother spanking you and apply that to your kids?
You know, to be frank, I think I don't have children. Hopefully someday I will. I think it honestly depends on the temperament of my child, because my younger brother was quite the opposite from me, and he was not as fast of a learner as I was, and he got the wooden spoon a lot more than I did. But I'm actually grateful for the fact that my mom, you know, utilized that as a tool in her arsenal, because timeout was whatever. We would get soap in our mouths, but I learned which brand soap, you know, I liked.
Okay, so this got your attention. Kelsey, thank you so much. We'll continue our conversation as whenever we pick up this topic and discuss it. We have a wide range of opinions about whether it's ever appropriate, whether it's ever beneficial to use physical discipline with a child, or whether that should be completely off the table for use. 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about the case of a Central Valley State Assembly member who was arrested last weekend for misdemeanor child abuse. As we've heard from our attorney expert, Paul Wallen of Tustin in Orange County, he thinks it's doubtful the charges will actually be filed, but that the assemblyman has already agreed that he'll take parenting classes, that he and his wife will go through a process to avoid using physical discipline with any of their three children. But the response he's gotten from constituents, he says, has included many who've supported him in this. My question for you is, do you think spanking ever is a positive approach in discipline usage in child rearing or not? If you're someone who was spanked as a child, what effect do you think it had, and how might that affect whether you use it or whether you have used it with your own kids? Ben in Tustin, I understand that you were spanked as a child and that you've also, as a parent, you've spanked your child. So what are your experiences on both ends of that, so to speak?
Yeah, well, it's the biggest mistake that a parent can ever make. I was spanked once only by my mother when I was about 7 years old, and it is one of the most impactful memories I have of my mother and of my childhood. I carried that resentment with me for many years, possibly for my whole life. And then, unfortunately, when I had a child, my wife and I both spanked him once when he was around 3 or 4 years of age, and he immediately learned that that was an appropriate response. And within a few days, he was hitting out at my wife and me, and then his young sister later on. So we taught him a very bad lesson, and I learned a very bad lesson from my mother.
Why do you think that her doing that once left such an imprint on you?
I think it's very hard for us as parents to understand the impact that things can have on children. And, you know, something like that can be so traumatic, so shocking to the psyche of a child that it can override so many other memories. And sadly, in life, negative memories so often crowd out positive memories. I have several negative memories of my mother, who was a wonderful woman. I love her to bits. I'm so grateful for everything she did for me. But those few negative incidents have crowded out so many hundreds of wonderful positive images and messages and memories.
Ben, I appreciate your call. Thank you for describing it both as a parent and when you were a child. Now, Dana and Redlands had different experience of this. Its spanking was definitely effective on me. It happened once. That's all it took. My husband, on the other hand, remembers laughing when his mom spanked him and telling her, "That doesn't hurt. I now have an 18-month-old son, wouldn't be against spanking, but wouldn't do it until he's at least 3 years old, when he can actually understand the consequences of his actions. Hopefully he takes after me and not my husband." Elizabeth Kim, USC, a professor of social work, your thoughts on Dana as well as our caller?
You know, it's interesting because spanking is really prevalent in the United States. It ranges from 65% to 85% of children reporting that they've been spanked before. And people endorse spanking. In 2016, women said, 66% of women said they think that children need spanking. 76% of men said children need spanking. You know, it's very prevalent, but the research is very clear that even though it might seem to have effective, you know, seem effective in terms of immediate compliance, it's actually pretty harmful in the long run.
Although we know that's not universal because we have listeners who say it was a positive experience for them. We have no reason to doubt that that's the case because they would know best. So we're in a study, of course, we're talking about on average, not individual response.
Right.
Let me share some other listeners. Well, let's talk Nancy in Pasadena. Nancy, you spank your kids. I understand you have three of them. So what are the terms under which you use spanking?
Our kids are now teenagers, so we no longer spank them. But we did from about 18 months until about 10 years old. We spanked for two reasons, for disrespect and disobedience. We spanked from one to three times, depending on the severity of what they had done. And then we would take time to comfort them and restore them back to the family without the sense of judgment. The incident was done, and they understood that there are consequences for their actions. And that's what I find is very effective about spanking, is that long before kids have developed rational skills, they can associate cause and effect.
All right. And what are your teenagers, have they ever talked with you about their perceptions of it now?
Yes, we've talked to them about it. They didn't see anything wrong with it. They actually understood that it was part of the training process for them. They're very well-behaved, well-spoken.
All right.
Be respectful people. They're not resentful. They're not traumatized.
All right. Nancy, I appreciate it. I'm so sorry. I want to get other points of view. And Sergio in Ventura said, I think it's absurd. People are overreacting to spanking. Obviously, it's not abusing a kid. At some point, kids don't listen. You have to do things to get their attention. It's not the first approach I take, but sometimes it works. That's Sergio. Rebecca in Silver Lake says, I was spanked as a child. I work in restorative justice now. It's clear that spanking impacts children in a negative way. Rebecca says, there are scientific studies showing it's harmful. We should call it hitting. Aaron in Santa Monica said, I grew up as the oldest five kids in a fundamental minister's house. Spanking was done with a belt or paddle. We were told it was done out of love. It was abhorrent. It's a cycle of abuse. It just builds confusion and resentment. That's Aaron in Santa Monica. Elizabeth in Glendale says, I'm a mandated reporter, a teacher, and I think spanking is detrimental to development. Julio in Downey says, it's case by case. I'm perfectly fine with spanking when the child warrants it. I have two daughters. One needs spankings, the other doesn't. Mostly a symbol at this point. My wife and I never spank her hard. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org, as it continues to be a highly divisive issue on among parents. My thanks to our guests, Elizabeth Kim, USC professor, and Paul Wallen, attorney who represents those accused of child abuse. Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a terrific start to your weekend. I'm joined this week by film critics Claudia Puig, who very relevantly is president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, the organization she heads, giving out its awards last weekend. We'll talk about those later this hour. Peter Rayner, Christian Science Monitor film critic, and Charles Solomon, the Animation Authority, Animation Scoop, and Animation Magazine. We begin with an animated feature, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. It's directed by Bob Persichetti. Peter Ramsey and Rodney Rothman. Phil Lord co-wrote the screenplay with Rothman. It's based on the Spider-Man characters Stan Lee and Steve Ditko created. It stars Shameik Moore and Miles Morales. Is a teenage boy growing up in Brooklyn who discovers his dimension isn't the only one that has a superhero with spider-like powers.
Hey, guys.
Wanda?
It's Gwen, actually.
Oh, you know her. Very cool.
I'm from another dimension. I mean, another dimension.
How many more spider people are there?
Save it for Comic-Con.
What's Comic-Con?
By the way, the late Stan Lee makes a vocal appearance in Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Charles, what'd you think?
This comes in with a 99% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes, and if anything, deserves better. It's fresh, it's funny without being snarky, it's dramatic without over-reliance on special effects, it's interesting, it's diverse, it's imaginative, it doesn't look like everything else. The kid who becomes Spider-Man is an African-American, son of an African-American cop father and a Puerto Rican nurse. He's just such a sympathetic character. Within the first couple of minutes of the film, you like him, you're rooting for him. He gets involved with spider persons from other dimensions, including one who's a spoof of anime girls with a giant robot. There's a black and white film noir Spider-Man who's coat always billows in the wind. That's Nicolas Cage doing the best thing I've heard him do in years. But what I liked about this is it doesn't look and move like everything else. You know, even this year, one of the Who's from The Grinch could have walked into Smallfoot's town and borrowed a cup of sugar and then gone over to Wreck-It Ralph's book club, and they wouldn't have looked out of place. Everything is so detailed, so homogenized, and tends to move in a very smooth, fluid kind of way. Here, they revel in their comic book ancestry. They use sound effects coming up as words. There are little wiggly lines that appear around their faces when their spidey sense kicks in. And instead of just working from mocap or doing this very...
Motion capture.
Yeah, motion capture, and doing this very kind of stolid, accurate animation. They're looking at something cartoonier, so it moves with different rhythms. The poses are strong. They're snap. It's dynamic. It's so much fun to watch. I've been to it twice, and before I saw it, I would have said, why bother holding animation awards this year? The Incredibles is just going to sweep everything. And now it's very much become a horse race between those two films, which are very different, both very good, but I think this is just a terrific film.
Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which is in wide release. Claudia, how did you see it?
I agree. I did double-check it is 97% on Rotten Tomatoes, just to be entirely accurate. But,
there's a Grinch out there, and it's not me this time.
Someone who just doesn't want to see it be 99 or 100. Please. But I really enjoyed it, too. It's bold storytelling. It's great voice cast. And the animation is so striking. It's enjoyable. It's fun. It's fresh. It's fierce. It's very striking, comic book style animation, keeping that aesthetic from the comic book, which I thought worked beautifully. And it has a really kind of an engaging heart. And the characters are, as you mentioned, Charles, very diverse, very disparate. You have a good sense of them. They're developed. It works perfectly. And we at LAFCA gave it our best animation award.
Which I've not seen the Spider-Man film, but love The Incredibles 2.
Yes.
So I was so surprised when I saw that the LA critics chose the Spider-Man film over Incredibles 2.
Yes.
So now I've got to see Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
And who would think that something about, how many Spider-Men have we seen? Who would think it would be fresh and inventive? But it is.
All right. What do you think, Peter?
I liked it a lot. I think it's really funny and fresh and irreverent. I do think it goes on a bit too long. There's a bit repetition.
About 10 minutes too long.
About 10 minutes too long. And I mean, everything and the kitchen sink is in this movie. But it's really fun. The co-producers of the Lego movies were also the producers of
Phil
this
Lord
film.
And Chris Miller.
Right.
Very
which
talented.
I think, explains some of the irreverence and funniness.
The wit,
it's a good job.
and Mahershala Ali in another big
he's everywhere. Yes.
From green book to green screen.
Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, rated PG. Again, it's in wide release. And Charles, interesting, three directors of the film, but that didn't inhibit it?
That's not a first. I think that the visuals for this are so complicated, they probably needed three to oversee everything, because there's CG with overlays to make it look like drawings. Instead of being so fully rounded, the characters have lines delineating their faces. So I suspect there's just a lot to keep track of.
All right. Here's a quick quiz. When's the last time we saw a film that had more directors than screenwriters? Wouldn't that be a stick to look at?
Yes.
How the West Was Won.
we need Wade for that.
Two screenwriters and three directors for Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse in wide release. Well, Mary Poppins Returns stars Emily Blunt and Lin-Manuel Miranda. Rob Marshall directs. David McGee's screenplay, of course, based on Travers' Mary Poppins stories. Poppins returns to Jane and Michael Banks, now all grown up, to help guide Michael's three children after their mother passes away.
Mary Poppins!
Close your mouth, please, Michael. We are still not a codfish. Jane Banks. Still rather inclined to giggle, I see.
Good heavens. It really is you. You seem hardly to have aged at all.
Really? How incredibly rude. One never discusses a woman's age, Michael. Would have hoped I taught you better.
Mary Poppins Returns, Peter.
Well, yes, of course. We all love the original 1964 movie, Chim Chim Cheree and all that. There's a built-in problem with this movie in the sense that we all bring our memories of the original film to this, and it doesn't live up to the original. I'm not sure any film could, given the circumstances. I thought it was okay. It has a sort of kind of lightness to it. I liked Emily Blunt. The Banks children are all grown up now. Ben Whishaw and Emily Mortimer have three kids of their own. Depression era London, and the mortgage is due, and they have to find the money for it, or else they have to leave the mansion and so forth. And so you have this kind of built-in Dickensian kind of situation, and alighting from the sky, of course, is Mary Poppins. And Emily Blunt, I think, is well cast. She can sort of do anything. She was great in A Quiet Place this year, extremely different role involving kids. And the score is sort of passable, but I don't recall coming out of it with any humming.
It's hard. The Sherman Brothers score.
I know. It's Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman do an okay job with this. But, Lin-Manuel Miranda is quite charming in a role playing a lamplighter. Colin Firth is a bank owner who may or may not be a good guy. You figure it out. I think what didn't work for me in the end is that this film, despite a lot of good intentions and good performances all around, particularly from Ben Whishaw and Emily Blunt, it doesn't have the magic, the liftoff that the original did. And it's not just because I remember the original. I just think it kind of, for a movie that depends so much on flying up into the sky, it doesn't quite get off. It's fairly earthbound.
Mary Poppins Returns, Charles.
I agree with Peter. I liked it. I didn't love it. I think Lin-Manuel Miranda kind of steals a lot of it because he is so charming and so talented. I think one of the problems is that Emily Blunt isn't Julie Andrews, whom we love and who has such a presence and such warmth. There is an animated sequence in it done in 2D, so it's kind of an homage to the old one. Nicely animated, a big fantasy music hall performance inside a Dalton Bowl. But again, I certainly didn't come out humming any of the songs, and I remember being so enchanted by the original movie and still, how can you not love Mary Poppins? Again, I think it was just a very hard act to follow, and they did their best, but it's not the same.
Yeah, I should point out that Dick Van Dyke does have a cameo in this.
Yes.
He shows up at the very end, folks, and he jumps up on a table, and I don't think it's CGI.
Oh, no. He still dances regularly.
Yeah, he's 90, I think.
Yeah.
It's wonderful to see him.
Everyone on the set was amazed when he did that.
All right.
In one take.
Mary Poppins Returns, starring Emily Blunt, Lin-Manuel Miranda, rated PG. It opens in wide release midweek next week. If Beale Street Could Talk is a romantic drama from the writer-director of the Oscar-winning film Moonlight, Barry Jenkins. If Beale Street Could Talk stars Kiki Layne and Stephan James, Regina King also with a prominent role in the film. James stars as woman in Harlem. I should say Kiki Layne and Stephen James star in the film as they scramble to prove fiancé innocent of a crime while carrying their first child.
We are drinking to new life. Tish gonna have Fonny's baby. And who's gonna be responsible for this baby?
The father and the mother.
When I hold you in my arms, I gotta hold our baby in my arms.
We'll find a way.
That child was born of sin. That child is your grandchild. What difference does it make how it gets here?
If Beale Street Could Talk, it's rated R. Claudia?
I like this film a lot. Kiki Layne and Stephan James are excellent as this pair of lovers who we meet initially, and we get a sense of their excuse me, we get a sense of their romance and their affection, and it's beautiful and lush and lyrical. And then, you know, as things evolve, we also get a sense of a potent sense of racism at this time. It was, of course, based on the novel by James Baldwin from 1974. The music is so beautiful. You got a little snippet of it in that clip. And again, we gave that score our award. It's just I generally think Barry Jenkins, who did Moonlight, of course, has just beautiful scores for his music, for his films. And it's also beautifully shot, meticulously production designed. It's excuse me, I'm sorry. It's just very lyrical and very transporting. It does occasionally feel more like a play than a film, but that's not taking anything necessarily away from it. I think it's a tribute to love and against racist hatred. I was moved by it.
What'd you think, Peter?
I like portions of this movie. I must say I wasn't the biggest fan of Moonlight, and I think this film has some of the pluses and minuses for me of that movie.
We're going to have to go to blows on that one. I was the biggest fan of Moonlight.
I know. I mean, most people were, including the Academy. But, you know, it's beautifully shot by James Laxton and Nicholas Britell wrote the score, both of whom worked on Moonlight. There's a kind of burnished, glossy quality to the romance that I think is beautiful to watch. There's an ardor to the way the two of them relate. But I also think that it's a little too, you know, dewy and ethereal for me. I mean, not since Romeo and Juliet has there been a couple like this. And it's sort of Barry Jenkins' directorial model, I think, is a director named Wong Kar-wai, whose most famous film was In the Mood for Love. Another film I'm on the negative on. I think that both of these directors sort of etherealize experience, sort of aestheticize experience, so that it kind of wafts into the ozone, which is particularly weird in this movie because there is that kind of, you know, a street sense of James Baldwin and that story and the racism coming through this as well. But it seems to me like Jenkins' real heart is with the ethereal stuff and not with the political stuff. But having said that, although I think the two leads are kind of hampered by what I described in the way that they're portrayed, but the supporting performances, the family is quite strong, and I'd like to single out Regina King, who's
we also gave supporting actress
gave supporting
to.
Actress
yeah.
to marvelous performance, and Brian Tyree Henry, who plays a friend of the lead, who's absolutely extraordinary. It's basically one sequence, but it's the most powerful monologue.
Well, we'll continue. If Beale Street Could Talk, we'll speak more about it and the atmospherics of the film versus Moonlighting, also from writer-director Barry Jenkins. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. So good to have you with us on Film Week, a very big week for movies. Larry Mantle with critics Charles Solomon, Peter Rayner, Claudia Puig. We're just wrapping up discussion on Barry Jenkins' film If Beale Street Could Talk, adapted from James Baldwin's novel, starring Kiki Layne and Stephan James, with Regina King in a very high-profile supporting performance as well. Just want to let you know that our show The Frame had interviews both with Barry Jenkins and with the composer Nicholas Britell. You can hear those at kpcc.org/theframe or link from our Film Week page. You know, Peter, you were saying that you felt like the ethereal really superseded the characterization of the film, if I was hearing you correctly. Or the,
right, which the, I think, you know, I mean, has its charms, but I think in the end, Barry Jenkins for me is more a director of moods than of narrative, and so that plays into some of what I liked about this movie, that, you know, a kind of poetic dreaminess that you know, the ardor comes through in some of the sequences with the characters. But I also think that it does, as I said, sort of waft off into the ozone when you're expecting a little more grit, particularly from, you know, a Baldwin-based a book.
And I was going to say, you know, my experience of Moonlight, I think about that film from time to time. It stayed with me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's not so much that I think of the men from the film. I think of the scenarios. I think of them in the setting. I picture them in the car.
In the
I picture
ocean.
Them in the
yes.
yeah.
Right.
It's
right.
The images
yes.
and
almost
I think
on a
of,
subconscious level, right? It's
yeah.
In, yeah.
I mean, it's a tone poem, which
yes.
you know, at its best, I think is a marvelous thing. It's ambitious to do something like that in mainstream cinema.
I think he did it absolutely perfectly in Moonlight. I completely agree with you, Larry. It's some of those images have stayed with me. I've seen it quite a few times, but they just have this haunting quality almost. And I think that his work is sort of soul stirring. It reaches deeper, and it kind of wants to play, I think, on that deeper. On that level, and there aren't that many. I can't think of really off the top of my head anybody else, Wong Kar-wai, who's doing that kind of filmmaking. So I really appreciate that poetic quality. I agree that it maybe didn't work as perfectly here as it did with Moonlight, but I think the combination of Nicholas Britell's music and James Laxton's cinematography and all of that, the way they all work together, creates this beautiful, soulful, emotional, poetic,
Reverie.
But I think what Peter identifies, which I find really interesting, is that there is a trade-off, that if you're serving the one, it's difficult
yes.
to serve the characters.
It's hard to do both. Yeah. I mean, at one point in this movie, there's a cuts of newsreels of you know, racist footage of cops beating blacks and so forth. And I think, you know, that was very jarring to me, because it's like he's telling us, Jenkins, let's not forget this is also a movie about, you know, the horrors of racism, and I want to show you that it's real, it's not poetic, etc. You know, but it sort of was layered in a way that
Whereas
I thought didn't
Spike
quite
Lee could
fit.
Do that in Black Klansman, and it worked better with his style,
yeah.
I think. Yeah.
If Beale Street Could Talk, from writer-director Barry Jenkins, at the Arclight Hollywood, the Landmark West L.A., rated R. Clint Eastwood directs and stars in The Mule as a 90-year-old horticulturist and World War II veteran who transports $3 million of cocaine through Michigan on behalf of a Mexican drug cartel. The film co-stars Bradley Cooper, Michael Pena, Andy Garcia. What'd you think, Peter?
I see Claudia's smoke rising from her head here. I sort of enjoyed this movie. It's a very, you know, crotchety, autumnal movie. I liked it more than The Old Man and the Gun, which was sort of Robert Redford's version of this kind of thing. You know, Eastwood really is pushing 90. It's a true story. There was a guy who was 90 and pushed over a decade 1,000 pounds of cocaine. For you know, El Chapo, who's now in the news also. What I didn't like about the movie is that whole aspect of this guy who's sort of been put out of business by the internet. He raised, you know, makes daylilies, and he has a terrible relationship with his daughter and his ex-wife and everybody. You know, it's just he's sort of a Gran Torino guy, and it's the same screenwriter too. But what bothered me was that he doesn't really care much about what he's transporting. He knows at a certain point that he's transporting cocaine, and yet it's not really a factor in the movie that you know, the damage that this these drugs can do to people. It's sort of like a sidelight.
He has an amoral perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it's an amoral perspective, and yet I think it's the sort of jaunty, melancholic tone doesn't indicate that. But I do think that I love Eastwood's kind of straightforward, no nonsense, unassuming way of both acting and directing. I think there's a sweetness to some of the film. Particularly later on when he sort of gets his comeuppance. The portrayal of the Mexican drug dealers is straight out of the playbook. But I do think that it's very much an old man's movie, and I don't mean that altogether.
Old white man's movie.
Well, I mean, look, I think old white men, old racist white men, the character I'm talking about, have as much place to be portrayed in a movie as anywhere else. It's just that
when they're portrayed as lovable. That's my big problem.
I mean, I thought that it was more self-reflective than that, and that he wasn't strictly, saying this guy's a wonderful guy and that, he really should be redeemed. I think that there is a certain self-criticism that's built into the role as it goes along.
What do you think, Claudia?
I hated this movie with every fiber of my being. The first line is a racial slur. He says to some Latino workers, "You're driving around in this taco wagon, you'd think you wanted to be deported." And that's literally the first line of the movie. So, that's going to be off-putting to a lot of people. You automatically go, okay, this is who this guy is. And I agree. Of course we can see depictions of all kinds of people. They don't have to be good people. But he wants to have it both ways. He's also kind of like, stops to help an African-American couple changing a tire. But then he insults them and calls them Negroes. And then they, give him a little talking, explaining that, no, we don't want to be called that anymore. And he goes, And then he meets some women. He thinks they're men, motorcyclists. And they say, no, we're actually dykes with bikes. And he goes, okay, bye, dykes. And, it came off really insulting. I think it came off racist, sexist, homophobic. He also gives himself not one, but two, three threesomes. Old 90-year-old man with young, beautiful women, and we're supposed to go, ha, 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 isn't this cute? And yes, he wasn't supposed to be a hero, but he was supposed to be kind of an engaging, crotchety old geezer. And you're right. He doesn't pay any attention to the fact that he doesn't even know he's transporting drugs until like the fourth run. And when he does, he doesn't seem to really care. He has terrible relationships with his wife and children. Then suddenly that's all resolved. I felt like it was all too neat. It was all telegraphed. There was just, I was offended by a lot of it. He plays himself as an old horn dog, basically.
Now, in Gran Torino, he says all kinds of slurs.
Yes, he does, but I preferred that film.
To the Hmong neighbors.
Because you learn something about the Hmong neighbors, and not that there has to necessarily be, I don't necessarily believe that people are redeemed. With Green Book, I didn't believe that you spend a few months with someone on the road and you go from being a racist to being an open-minded, tolerant person. It doesn't happen that easily, I don't believe. But in this case, I just feel like it was a collection of horrible stereotypic portrayals of Latinos. They were either, like he said, driving a car that looked like they should be deported, or they were drug dealers. Women were just there to be sort of foils. Women were two kinds. They were either sex objects or they were scolds. They were either, his wife who and his daughter who...
Played by Diane Weiss.
Diane Weiss.
Quite a good performance.
Really? I didn't think so at all. I thought, you have to work hard to get a bad performance out of Diane Weiss, but he got one.
That's not easy.
No. And I thought it did not work. And I am a big fan of Clint Eastwood. I'm not a fan of his politics. I'm not a fan of a lot of other things, but I have loved Letters from Iwo Jima, The Unforgiven, Mystic River. I really do like his movie. So I didn't go into it. I didn't know what this was about. And I was really appalled.
Well, I just, it's certainly not one of his best movies. But I do think that, a lot of the racism and the slurs and stuff that you mentioned in the movie were not meant to take that as, as endorsing who he is and that he himself is kind of clueless as to a lot of what he's doing. It's a different kind of attitude, I think, than someone who is, openly, racist throughout and demonstrates it, unequivocally.
I just felt he made him too endearing too. It felt not like endorsement, but tolerance of somebody who is really quite offensive.
The Mule is the film. It's written by Nick Schenck, Clint Eastwood, the director. He stars in the film. It's rated R in wide release. Capernaum is a Lebanese drama, and that country's official submission in the Oscar Foreign Language category for the upcoming awards. Nadine Labaki is the director and one of the co-screenwriters. Claudia.
I really like this film. This also won the jury prize at the Cannes Film Festival. I got a 15-minute standing ovation there. It's very moving.
Which even for Cannes, which gives long standing, yes. That's long even by Cannes.
I'm surprised that's going to stand up for 15 minutes.
We showed it at the film festival that I program in North Carolina, and it won the audience award there, too. It's a very emotional and very harrowing tale about a young boy who wants to sue his parents for having given birth to him. And he is very, you know, living the hardest Scrabble life you can imagine. He's having to commit crimes and steal and do all kinds of things just to keep the family afloat. And they're squatters. They're just barely getting by. And you really get a sense of this world in Beirut. It took them 6 months to shoot it. And she used mostly non-actors because she really wanted to get this sense of realism on the screen. And I thought it worked really well. It's a very harrowing portrait. It actually is sort of tear-inducing when you see the cruelty and the indifference to the poverty and how this child is treated. And the 12-year-old actor who plays him, Zayn Al-Rafia, is amazing. And there's also probably the best performance by a baby I've ever seen.
That's a new LAFCA category for your LA Critic Award.
Exactly.
Best performance by a baby.
For an actor under two.
So you'd have to have twins because they're all going to come in and both get the award. Peter, what'd you think of Capernaum?
Babies voted on by babies. sorry, folks. I really like this film a lot. It's terrific. I've had some issues with Labaki's films in the past. I think they're a little too glossy and slick. But I think sort of moving into the streets and using so many, you know, people who really have lived these lives in the movie has really, you know, amped up the authenticity. And Zayn Al-Rafia it's one of the best performances by someone under, what is he, 12?
He's 12. 12 when he made it, yeah.
I've ever seen. It's absolutely extraordinary. This is sort of a golden age for kid performances anyway. When you think of you know, Brooklyn Prince and Florida Project, you know, the kid in Lion. I mean, these are some really good performances. And yes, the one-year-old baby is, you know.
It is amazing.
You know, you never, usually.
You need to see it for that.
Usually when babies are in movies, you know, you can see they're dangling, you know, something off just out of focus so that they'll look at. But you just don't get that
it
here.
It was a very soulful little baby.
Yeah,
yes.
No, it's a really powerful movie.
Yeah. There was also Elsie Fisher in Eighth Grade.
Yes.
So yeah,
and the title character in Mirai.
Yeah,
I wonder
this is
why.
Yeah,
happening.
I don't know.
Maybe
must have been something in
soon.
The water at that.
Maybe more directors are having children. I have no idea.
All right, Capernaum is the film. It's rated R. The official submission for the foreign language Oscar from Lebanon for the upcoming awards. It's at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles, rated R. Coming up, we'll hear what our critics have to say about the performance film Springsteen on Broadway. He brings his intimate final show to Netflix subscribers. Also, Neverending Man, Hayao Miyazaki, the great Japanese animator. Charles will tell us about the documentary about Miyazaki. Those and more movies to be reviewed coming up on Film Week on 89.3. It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us with our critics, Peter Rayner, Claudia Puig, Charles Solomon. Next up, Netflix offering that starts streaming on Sunday, Springsteen on Broadway. His final show, the intimate show that he did for 236 performances on stage at the Walter Kerr Theater on Broadway. Tom Zimney is the director. Peter, what'd you think of Springsteen on Broadway?
It's really terrific. And why this movie isn't also being released theatrically, I have no idea. It's perfect for the big screen for audiences to see him. You know, this show was completely sold out on Broadway. Everybody I knew in New York, including all my family, couldn't get in. But in a way, it's better to see it this way, except for the live aspect, because you really get a very intimate close-up. It's beautifully directed and envisioned everything else by a Tom Zimney. It's very literary also. He basically talks about his entire life in somewhat chronological order. And it's beautifully spoken because it's taken from his best-selling autobiography, Born to Run. And so there's a very meditative, very self-deprecating quality to this. You know, he says, "I'm Mr. Born to Run, and I live 10 minutes from where I was born."
Yes.
You know, and
funny.
You know, I've never been inside a factory.
I've never held an honest job in my life.
Yeah, I mean, it's wonderful. It's only him and his guitar. At one point, Patty Scialfa, his wife and backup singer or singer in the E Street Band, joins him. But basically, it's just him reminiscing and musing and talking about his life in very deep emotional terms. He talks about his mother and his fraught relationship with his father and what New Jersey meant to him, and you know, you would never really know from this the extent of his the stratospheric extent of his career. He doesn't really indulge in a lot of that. I've seen him twice live, you know, once in the early days when he would throw himself into the audience, and one in Madison Square Garden about 10 years ago. But this, I think, is the most powerful one-to-one experience I've had with both himself and his music.
What do you think, Claudia?
Absolutely. Full disclosure, I'm a rabid Bruce fan. I've seen him 11 times.
Wow.
Did a pilgrimage to Freehold, New Jersey, where he's from, in Asbury Park. I went to the Stone Pony. I've been a fan since my 20s. So,
you and Chris Christie.
Yeah. That's the only area in which I have any overlap with Chris Christie. I was kind of predisposed to love this, and I did. I cried, actually, because he is so open. I did read his autobiography, of course, but the way in which he talks about his 93-year-old mother who's had dementia for the last 7 years, and how he contrasts his parents. His father was he had a very fraught relationship with his father, and there was this sort of punitive, he didn't understand it, but he looked up to him as kind of this ideal of what a man should be. In fact, that's why he started wearing work shirts and things like that, his father was a factory worker. He said, he of course has never spent a moment in there, and he, you know, says, "Standing before you is a man who has become wildly and absurdly successful, writing about something of which he has absolutely no personal experience, but his father did." And so he, you know, absorbed some of his father, but he had this very difficult relationship. His mother, on the other hand, was exactly the opposite. She was a beacon of light and happiness and joy and was loving and loved to dance. And so, you know, now, even though she's been, you know, she's had a dementia all these years, she still dances. And he talks about that. And I defy anyone to watch that and not just cry. It's so beautiful. He's really a poet. He's kind of the poet laureate for the working man.
And for him to be able to convey the emotion of that speaks to his skill as a performer, that he can convey that.
Absolutely.
And speaking of which, I mean, I did find it. Isn't it strange that he has never acted in a movie, that he has never gone Hollywood in any way?
Thank goodness.
I mean,
even Bob
Dylan, you know,
Pat
Garrett and
Billy the Kid, yeah.
But and he has such presence, and he's such a good performer.
Yes.
That, I mean, in a way, I guess it's sort of our loss, assuming that he could find the role that would do him justice, that he hasn't, because so many performers, singers have done well as actors in the movies. I kind of regretted watching this that he hasn't done that as well.
Well, there's still time.
And as vital as he is, and he comes across still very strong and vital, he's 69, there's kind of an elegiac quality here where he's looking back on his life and you can feel that he really is looking at, because he's had an extraordinary
success.
He also
gives a tribute to Clarence Clemens.
Oh, yes. It's really, and the E Street Band. It's just wonderful. It's perfect.
Yeah.
Springsteen on Broadway, unrated. It streams on Netflix starting this Sunday. Neverending Man, Hayao Miyazaki, the great Japanese animator, and a documentary about his life. Charles, does it do him justice?
Yes. There have been a couple of these. There was one a few years ago, The Kingdom of Dreams and Madness.
Yeah, I enjoyed that film.
Yeah, but the director was following the studio cat around. This is a much more intimate, much realer portrait of Miyazaki. It begins with his 2013 announcement that he was retiring, that horrified everybody. But then he almost immediately went to work on a short film for the Ghibli Museum, where he makes films that are only shown there. No one's ever seen them anywhere else. But as he starts working on this film, he realizes there are technical things that he can't just draw. So Suzuki-san, his longtime producer, introduces him to a group of young CG artists. And in the beginning, he's complaining. He's talking, I'm just a pensioner. I'm an old geezer. My eyesight isn't good. I don't have any more energy. All these people are having funerals. These young people stimulate him, and he starts seeing, okay, you can do this, but you need to alter it so it does this better. That when you move this character, remember, this caterpillar has just been hatched. He's a newborn. He can't move as well. He doesn't know what he's looking at. You have to consider that. And you see him get younger on the screen, that suddenly he's walking differently and he's fidgeting at his desk. He's got so much energy. And towards the end of the film, he comes to Suzuki-san and says, I have an idea for a new feature. We can bring it out in 2019 before the Olympics. Do your usual magic to find the money. And he is at work on a new film. And it's most of it is shot in the little studio he has. It's a separate building at Studio Ghibli. And you see him making ramen for lunch and making coffee and drawing. He doesn't draw like an old man. It's a very intimate, well-focused portrait of this great filmmaker whom LAFCA is honoring with its Career Achievement Award.
All right. Neverending Man, Hayao Miyazaki, from director Kaku Arakawa. The documentary opens this coming Tuesday in selected theaters. Check your local listings. And as Charles said, the 2018 Career Achievement Award from the LA Film Critics Association will go to Miyazaki at their awards next month. Mortal Engines stars Hera Hilmar and Hugo Weaving. Peter Jackson wrote the screenplay along with Philippa Boyens and Fran Walsh, his collaborators. Christian Rivers makes a feature directorial debut. Claudia, what'd you think of this action fantasy?
Not much. It's set in the 23rd century, and it has a kind of a cool dystopian steampunk look to it, and that's maybe the best thing about it. There's practically no character development. The story feels stilted and pretty uninteresting, or the dialogue feels stilted. The story feels uninteresting, kind of absurd. It's really forgettable. It's got an interesting look, but it's kind of a bloated story, and there's little flashes of imagination, but it feels familiar. It feels like a lot of, you know, sort of based on either a YA novel or based on a video game. It's a wasteland. There's dwindling resources. The only thing that's kind of interesting is that there's these cities that are, London has become this giant rolling city, and it kind of devours other cities. And so that's kind of an interest. And there's a couple little, there isn't much humor at all, but there's a couple little moments where they show sort of artifacts from the 21st century, and they show minions and cracked cell phones. Like, oh, they refer to our era as the screen age, and they show sort of little little laptops. Yeah. I mean, so that was, you know, there were moments like that, but they were few and far between.
Mortal Engines, rated PG-13 in wide release, from director Christian Rivers, written by Peter Jackson, Philippa Boyens, and Fran Walsh, based on Philip Reeve, his book Mortal Engines. We are going to be taking a break on Film Week. When we come back, we'll find out about the sci-fi drama Bird Box, starring Sandra Bullock and Trevante Rhodes, Susan Beard, the director of the film, and we'll find out about Tyrell, that's a film starring Jason Mitchell and Caleb Landry Jones. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Coming up, we'll talk about the LA Film Critic Association Honors, one of the most influential critics groups in the country. I don't know if, when you say most influential critics groups, I don't know what that means. Often the Oscars don't take their cue from the critics. Nonetheless, very esteemed, and of course, you know, they're my favorites. We'll hear about their honors coming up. But first, let's review the new film from Suzanne Beer, Bird Box. It's written by Eric Heisserer. Claudia, what'd you think?
Well,
all right, Peter. What did you think?
Film should have been called Bird Brain.
I thought this was an occasionally riveting, very apocalyptic sci-fi. Very, in the very beginning, I was kind of with it. But do you remember the movie The Happening by M. Night Shyamalan?
Yes.
It kind of takes that same concept of like something terrible has been unleashed and people are committing mass suicides. I saw it on the day of the Kavanaugh hearing, right after he testified. I literally saw it like a half hour after
testified. You saw it a long time ago.
I saw it a long time ago. And, you know, to watch a movie when you're feeling that down and depressed about life and then to watch mass suicides, I wasn't in the best headspace to see it. But Sandra Bullock gives a good performance. She does have some chemistry with Trevante Rhodes, but it doesn't come together.
Yeah, the central premise is that people see this monster or something, and then they kill themselves after they've seen it. But we never see the monster. So I think it's sort
maybe
of
that's a good thing.
Well,
we live on.
given the rest of them, yeah, it's a miscalculation because people kind of look up and then they go wacko, and you sort of it's the whole thing is just too amorphous. They should have shown something. You know, I faulted A Quiet Place, a movie where you're not supposed to make any sounds. I thought it was a terrific movie, mm-hmm. but I think they could have had less of the monsters in that movie.
I agree.
You know, I mean, that was the only thing I didn't like about it. But here I think they could have had a little bit more.
Bird Box. Bird Box, starring Sandra Bullock and Trevante Rhodes, is at the Landmark Region Theater in Westwood, and it begins streaming on Netflix on Friday the 21st. It's rated R. Tyrell stars Jason Mitchell and Caleb Landry Jones. Film written and directed by Sebastian Silva. Peter?
Yeah, maybe I'm missing something, but this is a movie about a guy who he goes with his buddy to a friend's birthday party bash in the Catskills. He's the only black guy among a bunch of white guys who are, you know, drinking and cavorting too much. But there's a sort of ominousness to the atmosphere of this film where you expect something, you know, racially bad to happen, but it never really happens. And so even though Jason Mitchell is quite strong in the film, I thought it was going to play out in some way that was, you know, dramatically galvanizing. And instead, it just sort of sputters out. It seems to be going in a Get Out sort of direction. And instead, it really goes in no direction at all.
Tyrell is unrated. Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica. That Way Madness Lies, a documentary directed by Sandra Lukow. Claudia?
I thought this was fascinating. It's a pretty devastating portrait of how a family copes with a family member who has schizophrenia, paranoid schizophrenia. And Sandra Lukow's brother, Dwayne, is kind of normal or eccentric all his life, but then in his 40s develops this very serious mental illness, which is a little unusual for schizophrenia. Usually happens in, you know, your late teens or 20s. And you watch, it has horrible consequences in terms of not just emotionally and psychologically, but economically. You know, he blows through his money. He's the guy who sends the money to the Nigerian prince. Now we know who those people are.
Yeah. and there's a lot of home movie footage and footage that is, you know, of Dwayne. And that adds to the power of the film that you can actually sort of see in progressive time what's going on through real footage. And the sister who made the film, it's very touching, her connection to all of this, because at a certain point, you know, self-preservation kicks in, and she has to deal with that as well.
And it shows how broken the mental health system is, too.
Yeah, exactly. That's the main point.
Yeah.
The Way Madness Lies, documentary at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica, unrated. Claudia, you saw the re-release of Deadpool 2 that's in a PG-13 cut. It's called Once Upon a Deadpool. Just briefly, what'd you think?
It was fun. It was entertaining. It has a lot of that same sort of snarky irreverence that Deadpool has, obviously. But they added this little device of Fred Savage, kind of spoofing off of his role when he was a child in Princess Bride. And he's very fun. As an adult, and Ryan Reynolds has really, you know, gotten down that sort of dry irony. And I have to admit, I didn't see the first Deadpool, so I'm a little bit not up on the Deadpool oeuvre. But but I thought this worked. It's cute. You know, it's funny. It's the action scenes are still fine, and I think the addition of Fred Savage and sort of the kind of snarkiness about, you know, kind of bringing in that movie, and they say he was he was kidnapped, and then they say, no, he's unsolicited location enhancement.
Once Upon a Deadpool, rated PG-13 in select theaters. Charles, the 20th annual animation show of shows returns at select Lemley theaters.
Interesting reminder of how diverse animation can be in its look and techniques and media. Well worth seeing just for one film by a young German woman done with clay and stop motion that evokes everything from breakdancing to Martha Graham to martial arts kata. This is clearly a major talent. Some other very interesting films, a few not so great, but again, well worth seeing at a time when so many of our animated features have this homogenized look to them. Animation can be more.
15 animated shorts from around the world. The 20th annual animation show of shows at Lemley's Theaters in Glendale and Santa Monica, unrated. You can check your show times. Also, Nicholas Rogue's Don't Look Now from 1973. Rogue passed away a couple weeks ago. Don't Look Now be at the Fine Arts Theater. Donald Sutherland, Julie Christie, Peter.
Yeah, this is a really scary, creepy Daphne du Maurier adaptation. Probably Nick Rogue's best movie. Everyone always says that the famous sex scene in this film was done for real. It's unsubstantiated. But the fact that people think that is a tribute to how erotic this film is. It's quite a movie.
Again, it's at the Fine Arts Theater in Beverly Hills. Now, the LAFCA Awards, their winner for Best Picture, Roma from Alfonso Cuarón. Burning is the runner-up. Deborah Granik, for one of my favorites of the year, Leave No Trace, wins for Best Director. Cuarón, the runner-up for Roma. Best Actor, Ethan Hawke for First Reformed. Ben Foster, the runner-up for Leave No Trace, as the dad in that film. Best Documentary, Minding the Gap. Shirker's the runner-up. And the best screenplay, Nicole Holofcener, Jeff Witte, and Can You Ever Forgive Me? The runner-up, Deborah Davis, Tony McNamara for The Favorite. And Spider-Man, Into the Spider-Verse, beating out Incredibles 2 for the best animated. Claudia, you're the president of the organization. Is there some daylight between yourself and the New York and the other organizations?
There is. I just wanted to correct one little thing because I think there might have been a mistake written here. Our best documentary was Shirkers. Our best editing was Minding the Gap.
Oh, okay.
So there's a little. But, what I'm most proud of, I think they're fantastic films, and we had no discussion about let's try to make this more diverse or anything like that. There's no PC effort. However, 13 out of the 18 award winners are women or people of color. So I thought that was a really, and that just shows you that, you know, it happens naturally and organically when the films are there. And it just, it really made me happy. I'm a huge fan of Roma, personally, so it's like my favorite movie of the decade, so I was really happy to see that.
All right, Claudia Puig, film critic and L.A. Film Critic Association president, Peter Rayner, Christian Science Monitor film critic, and animation authority and critic Charles Solomon. All of us wish you a wonderful weekend from KPCC and Film Week.